talk to you about this, signorina. She froze. It lasted only a second, and she was instantly back to normal, but he had seen it. He shifted his weight to the other foot, uncertain how to handle this. Trust in her prompted him to say, blurt out, actually, "What happened?"
"Excuse me?" she asked.
"With Belli. How did his name get out?" He'd used the passive voice, suggesting that the name might well have flown from the Questura on angel wings, thus allowing her the chance to lie to him if she chose. She looked at him, away, back at him, then touched the keyboard. He could see only a sliver of the screen, but it sufficed for him to see it grow black. She straightened herself in her chair and folded her hands in her lap.
"Friends of mine have a daughter," she said,
then stopped to give a small cough and looked down at her hands.
"She's 19, and I've known her since she was a baby. She's a sweet girl, very clever. Has always called me Zia Elettra."
She might as well have been speaking to her folded hands.
"I went to dinner with her parents a few months ago. They both seemed different, tense. So I asked them what was wrong. And they said they were worried about Livia, that she had a new boyfriend, and what she said about him made them nervous."
"What did they say?"
"That she was completely under his control. Waited around for him to call, didn't see her other friends anymore because he didn't want her to."
She shot a glance towards him, adding,
"First love. It happens."
Brunetti nodded but said nothing.
"She'd talked to me about boyfriends in the past, but that was the first I'd heard about him. Then Lino referred to him as Costantino, and I told myself to stay calm. There had to be a lot of them in the city."
She opened her hands and stretched her fingers, then joined them together again. "But?" Brunetti ventured.
"I asked, and they told me his name."
He watched her press her lips together, as though she were back in that restaurant with her friends and wished she had done that then.
"They saw my reaction and asked me what was wrong."
She looked at Brunetti then, and he saw defiance writ large on her face. Brunetti took the two familiar steps backwards and leaned against the windowsill. He folded his arms across his chest and waited.
"I've known her since she was a baby."
He noticed that her fingers were interlocked and tightly held. Brunetti thought and half hoped she'd said this to prepare a defense, to explain her obligation to the girl, to say it just slipped out before she thought of it, that she was so surprised that she had no idea what she was saying, didn't think at all about her professional responsibility.
"So I told them about Lucia Arditi, and what he did to her, and what his mother did to help him, and that this was the kind of people they were."
Brunetti thought about this for a while and then asked, "And when he was attacked?"
"It was 3 weeks later," she said. "I was shocked."
Then, as if truth had reminded her to whom she was speaking, she added,
"But I wasn't surprised."
"Have you seen her parents since you had dinner with them?"
"No."
"Do you think her family had it done?" She looked up, and seeing Brunetti's expression, asked,
"Would you have expected them to call me and tell me?"
Ignoring her question, he asked, "And the girl?"
"I told you. I haven't seen any of them or heard from them since we had dinner."
She untied her fingers and waved a hand in the air.
"Maybe I never will."
"Don't be melodramatic, Elettra," Brunetti said before he thought. She grimaced, embarrassed.
"I am, aren't I?"
"Yes."
"What will you do?"
Brunetti shrugged. He turned to the window, set at the opposite end of the building from his own. It looked across the same canal, but from a different floor and a different angle. The view changed. He saw the same thing, but standing here it looked entirely different. Creon had told Antigone that orders were orders and had to be obeyed, whether they were large or small, right or wrong.
"I don't know," he told her, and then, "Send those charts up to me, would you?"
He left her office and went back to his own. Chapter 24 By the time he reached his office, he and his conscience had come to an agreement. Signorina Elettra had acted instinctively to save someone she loved from harm. It was different from pushing someone out of the way of a speeding car, more like pushing the loved one clear and in doing so causing the car to crash. Although he saw the difference, he told himself it was over. He had made his choice. The one she had made would remain between the two of them, and over time would gradually disappear from the common memory of the Questura. Almost persuaded, he decided to return to the matter at hand. He needed to talk to Grifoni about the coupons, just as he needed to get a better sense of the pharmacy and the pharmacist. As he climbed the stairs to Grifoni's office, Brunetti reflected on the fact that few of his colleagues were as sly as Claudia, fewer still as inventive. Her ability to mold herself into the person who would be most able to understand a witness or suspect was remarkable, as was the ease with which she adapted her speech, pronunciation, intonation, range of reference, to resemble theirs in almost undetectable ways. That, once established, she went on to approving of their ideas and prejudices by almost imperceptible nods and smiles. Brunetti could never recognize the exact moment she became their second selves, although he had often seen the moment the second skin dropped from her and she returned to her caustic, relentless self. He found her in her office, leaning back in her chair, listening to someone talk to her on the phone. She was sitting sideways at her desk, so she saw Brunetti arrive. She smiled and held up two fingers, and within seconds the rhythm of her responses began to signal impatience. The other speaker did not resist for long, and the conversation ended. She stood and stretched her arms above her head.
"Does the outside world still exist?" she inquired.
Brunetti nodded and stepped back, holding up his arms in the manner of the men who direct aeroplanes to their parking spaces on an airfield. Repeatedly taking small steps backwards through the doorway, he waved her towards him and out of the office. She followed him gladly.
"Let's visit the pharmacy," he suggested, handing her the coupons that had been in Tullio Gasparini's drawer.
"Oh, good," she said with feigned delight. "I've been wanting some new lipsticks for weeks. Maybe I can buy them with Aunt Matilda's coupons."
The day was friendly, so they decided to walk to Valareso and take the number 2 to San Marcuola and walk from there. Riva degli Schiavoni was crowded, even this late in November, reminding Brunetti of how empty it had been only a few years ago. Having vowed to himself not to grumble about the awful changes to the city, he contented himself with telling Claudia about some of the places they passed. There was the Vaporetto that had been tipped upside down years ago during a storm. He could no longer remember how many people had died trapped inside. As they progressed toward San Marco, he told her about the Sette Martiri, men shot by the Germans during the war in reprisal for a missing German soldier who, it turned out, had fallen into the water, drunk, and drowned. She gave a shrug that could be made only by someone whose grandparents had lived through the war.
"That happened to a great-uncle of mine. He was 11," she said. "Nothing was named after him, though.
They came down the bridge and decided to pass through the piazza before getting the Vaporetto. They walked out into the middle of the open glory, and Grifoni turned back to look at the facade of the basilica. When Brunetti stopped beside her, she said, "The first time I came to Venice, I must have been 17, 18, it was a school trip. I spent an hour standing here and turning around in a circle to see it all. Again and again. The library, the pillars, the basilica, the bell tower. And now some days I walk across it without paying much attention."
"It happens to us all," Brunetti said, turning away from the basilica and starting towards the calle that would take them down to the Valaresso stop.
"My landlady, she's retired, must be in her late 60s, Grifoni began. "She taught little kids all her life, but now she has no work to go to, so she spends her days walking around the city with her husband."
"Is she Venetian?" he asked.
"As much as you are."
"She's just looking?"
"Yes. She said she finds something new every day, or they go back to places they remember from their youth."
"Does she have a guidebook?"
"No. I asked her that. She said she just keeps her eyes open. And she said she always keeps looking up. So when there are too many tourists, she goes down into Castello, or over to Santa Marta, or some place where there won't be a lot of them. And she looks at things and always manages to find something new."
"And then?"
"From what I can understand, then she goes home, cooks dinner, and watches television with her husband."
"Well, praise the Lord that she still walks and sees the city all day."
Grifoni stopped in her tracks and stared at him.
"Praise the Lord?" she asked.
"Don't panic, Claudia. It's something my mother said."
"Ah,"
she said, and resumed walking. They got on to the number 2 that was just leaving. There was a sharp breeze, so they went inside and walked towards the back. After they sat down, Brunetti asked, "How do we proceed?" Grifoni gazed at the passing buildings and finally said,
"I could be her niece. You know, the one from Naples, with the strong Neapolitan accent," she began.
And as she continued, her accent weaved away from the elegant Italian she normally spoke towards some southern variant of the same language, one in which the vowels would have to be written differently. Looking out the window, she planned her niecehood.
"I come to visit 2 or 3 times a year, and this time Zia Matilde gave me these coupons, and told me to go shopping with them and get something to make myself beautiful."
It was on the tip of Brunetti's tongue to tell her she hardly needed help to do that, but he chose instead to say,
"I'll go in when you do, and find something to buy. I'd prefer to see and hear whatever I can of your attempt to use the coupons."
Grifoni nodded in approval of his plan, then said,
"It might be better if I told them it's all for her."
She gave him a broad smile and added,
"Pity I didn't think of making a shopping list in wavy, uncertain handwriting. That would make things look even more authentic."
"You'll manage," Brunetti said,
just as the Vaporetto pulled up at the stop. 3 people got off with them. They went around the back of the church and out to San Leonardo and turned left. As they approached the pharmacy, Brunetti fell behind and let Grifoni proceed and enter alone. He paused to study the masks in the window of the shop next door, and gave each one the same glance he gave to tourists, distant, uninterested, and faintly displeased. He allowed a few minutes to pass before he went into the pharmacy. His eyes passed over Grifoni, alone at the counter talking to a salesgirl. She had had time to do her shopping. Before her on the counter, Brunetti saw 3 boxes of lipstick and a few other small items he couldn't recognize. She was just handing the coupon to the younger woman. The salesgirl took it and examined it, then looked at Grifoni.
"But you are not Signora Gasparini,"
she said with no special inflection.
"No, I'm her niece,"
Grifoni said, dulling her consonants so that her Neapolitan accent all but fell onto the counter with a heavy thud.
"Ah,"
the young woman said. Then, quite pleasantly, she asked,
"Could you wait a moment? I'll get Dottor Donato."
"Certainly," Claudia answered.
"I'll go and have a look at the face creams."
Brunetti busied himself looking at dental floss and toothbrushes, even took one down and studied the bristles through the plastic container. An older man came to the counter, tall and robust, with dark hair and a mustache. Brunetti saw his name on the plastic card on his lapel, Dottor Donato. Grifoni had returned to the counter, a pale blue box in her hand. The man asked her,
"May I help you, signora?"
Brunetti replaced the toothbrush and picked up a bottle of mouthwash.
"Yes, if you'd be so kind, dottore,"
Grifoni said.
"My aunt asked me to come and pick up some things for her. She gave me some coupons and told me I should pay with them."
Her voice was filled with the warmth and friendliness of the South, and Brunetti, who was looking at the bottle and not at Grifoni, was sure her smile was equally warm. He took a glance and saw that the coupon was still on the counter. Grifoni picked it up and handed it to the pharmacist. He nodded his thanks and examined it carefully, his eyebrows raised. He had a face on which suspicion would look out of place. Round and rosy-cheeked, he had large brown eyes that looked on a world they had judged to be a friendly and interesting place. Smiling, he set the paper back on the counter and asked,
"And you're Signora Gasparini's niece, you say?"
"Yes, I am,"
Grifoni answered, just as if she had not heard his last two words.
"I come up to visit her every few months."
She shifted the tenor of her voice to semi-guilt and added,
"I don't come as often as I should, I know."
Then lightness played forth again as she said,
"But she's my aunt, and I'm always glad to come here to visit her and try to help her while I'm here."
Dottor Donato braced his hands against the counter and leaned closer to her. In a voice so low that Brunetti could barely make out the words, he said,
"I can understand how someone would want to help her."
His voice was filled with affection and regard.
"She's been my client for some time."
Brunetti, who knew the date on which he'd filled Signora Gasparini's first prescription, looked down to continue reading the label on the bottle in his hands. He moved to the left, farther away from them, and began to study the tubes of sunblock. A moment later, a young male pharmacist was at his side, asking,
"May I help you, signore?"
"Yes," Brunetti said. "My wife and I are going on a cruise, and she asked me to get some sunblock because she read somewhere that we should wear it even in the winter, especially if we're going to be at sea."
He smiled at him and added,
"The reflection, I think."
"That's certainly true."
The pharmacist, whose plastic tag also read Dottor Donato, answered, and asked what level of protection his wife had told him to get. Brunetti first looked startled, and then said he didn't know anything about that, and asked what the doctor would recommend. As the young man explained the difference between the various creams, Brunetti shot a glance at Grifoni and the older pharmacist, with whom she seemed to be in the midst of a discussion. He heard the pharmacist say, "any such person," but the rest of the phrase was blotted out by the voice of the young man, who held out a yellow tube, saying,
50. It should be good for even the brightest sun."
Brunetti smiled, thanked him, and said,
"My wife asked me to get some aspirin, too."
"Pills or effervescent, sir?"
"Pills, please," he answered,
hoping they would be behind the counter or in the back room,
somewhere that would take him away and allow Brunetti to hear the continuing conversation between Grifoni and the pharmacist, who was still behind the counter, but now looking stiffer and decidedly less amiable than before.
"If you have no objection, signora," Brunetti heard when he tuned back into their conversation, "I'll keep the coupon until your aunt comes in."
The tone was pleasant and light. His face was not.
"If you'd like to pay for those items you've chosen,"
he began, but left the sentence unfinished and lingering in the space between them.
"No," she said amiably. "I think it would be better to let my aunt decide what to do."
"Then I'll keep them, shall I, until she comes in?"
Saying this, Dottor Donato swept the items towards him. Brunetti's pharmacist stepped out from the back room, and he went to the counter to pay for the sunblock and the aspirin. Two other people had come in while the younger man was getting the aspirin, and they stood between Brunetti and the owner, whose full attention was still on Grifoni.
"I look forward to seeing your aunt," the pharmacist said, opened a drawer and placed the items into it.
Grifoni thanked him for his help and started towards the door. The pharmacist stared after her, cold-eyed, the intensity of his expression at odds with his rosy cheeks. Then he turned to the next client, a robust woman with tightly permed white hair who gave him a warm smile.
"Ah," he said in a voice grown suddenly friendly, "cara signora Marini, how can I help you?"
Brunetti waited until Signora Marini began to speak, took his change, turned and walked slowly to the door. Outside, Grifoni stood a few meters away, looking into the window at a panorama of masks. The Chinese proprietor sat at a counter at the back of the shop. When Brunetti stopped beside her, Grifoni said,
"I was at the hairdresser's last week, and the girl who was washing the hair of the old woman beside me asked her if she wanted the anti-yellow treatment."
She pointed to one particularly horrid mask and continued,
"I interrupted, then told her I thought that was an unkind thing to say in a city with so many Chinese residents."
After a moment she turned away from the window and added,
"But now I think I shouldn't have reproached her."
"I've noticed how your sense of humor wins you friends everywhere you go, Claudia," Brunetti said, and then asked, "What did Dottor Donato tell you?"
"First, that my aunt has often told him that she has only one nephew, so he wondered how it was that I could be her niece. I laughed and told him that I was actually the daughter of a cousin of hers, and that in Naples that fell into the category of niece."
"And he?"
"He was very apologetic, but insisted that he couldn't allow it because her name was on the coupon, and only her signature was valid."
She pulled the coupons out of her bag and handed him one, pointing to Signora Gasparini's surname written at the top.
"There's no place for a signature."
"What do you make of it?" Brunetti asked.
"It could be that he's a scrupulously honest man and won't permit it because he thinks it's wrong," she said,
then grew silent as she considered other interpretations. Impatient, Brunetti asked,
"Then why lie about needing a signature?"
"Exactly," she said in full agreement. "There was no need. He could simply have refused."
They had been idly walking back towards the Embarcadero when Brunetti said,
"I think we should talk to your Aunt Matilda again."
"So do I,"
Grifoni agreed. Like characters in a cartoon, they wheeled around and turned into the calle that would take them back to the San Marcuola Embarcadero. As they passed in front of the Church of the Carmini, Brunetti said,
"Since you're best friends now, perhaps you should do the talking."
"But you're the man."
He turned his head slowly towards her, not breaking step, and said nothing.
She's in her 80s, Guido, so however much she might find me amusing and good for a talk about this and that, the man is still the one who decides.
You sound pretty accepting of that, Brunetti remarked.
It's her age,
Grifoni said.
Besides, she didn't spend all that money on cosmetics to make herself more attractive to women.
That remark brought them to the front door. Brunetti rang and explained to Beata that they'd like to speak to the signora again. With no hesitation, she snapped open the door that led them into the entrance hall. Upstairs, the young woman welcomed them with a smile.
The padrona was very happy about your visit, signori. She's talked about it ever since. I'm happy you came again.
She stepped back to let them enter and turned to lead them down the corridor. At the door of the living room, she paused.
Let me tell her you're here.
Of course, answered Brunetti, to whom she had spoken, ignoring Grifoni.
They heard indistinct voices from inside, then Beata came back and opened the door fully to allow them to enter. She left, closing the door behind her. Signora Gasparini sat where she had been the previous day, looking as if she had not moved from her chair. The dragons were still upon her, and the stripes still led from her waist to just above her feet. Nor had the tremor abated. The motion, still minimal, was each time made more obvious by her red cloud of hair as it jerked to the side and back.
"How nice of you to come see me again,"
she said, speaking in the singular, smiling at Brunetti with real delight and raising her hands in a welcoming gesture.
"We're delighted to come back, signora," Brunetti said, stepping aside to give the old woman a clearer view of Grifoni. "It's a pleasure to come into such an imposing room, and even more pleasant for both of us to be so warmly greeted."
Signora Gasparini looked at Grifoni then, and gave the cool nod courtesy demanded a stranger be given.
"Yes,"
Signora Gasparini said, looking away and around the room as though seeing it for the first time.
"It is lovely, isn't it? It was my grandfather's study, and I use it to receive visitors."
She smiled and waved to include everything in the room.
"I think it gives them a sense of who we are."
Brunetti had no way of telling whether the rhythm with which the tremors came and went was the same as the last time.
"Indeed it does, signora,"
gushed Grifoni, looking around as though she could not have enough of it.
"It's all so beautiful."
Signora Gasparini, who still apparently did not recognize Grifoni, smiled, unable to contain her pleasure at such heartfelt compliments. She invited them to sit, and they did.
"Could you tell me again what you've come for?"
she asked, trying to sound forceful but unable to disguise her confusion at their return. Brunetti was pierced with pity for her. Grifoni was right. She was tough and asked no quarter of life.
"We came because of your nephew," Brunetti began, and then added, "Tullio, just to be sure. He wanted us to try to sort out the confusion with the pharmacy. But I'm afraid I still don't understand what happened, so I've come back to ask for your help. I think that will make it possible to have the cash returned," he said, including the talismanic word to maintain her interest.
"Help?"
she asked, as if she could not understand the word.
"Could you explain to me how you were given the coupon, signora? I don't think I can try to persuade Dr. Donato to give you your money until I understand just how this came about."
Brunetti saw her grasp her hands together.
"It's because of the prescriptions," she said.
"Which prescriptions are those, signora?"
"The ones I have filled every month. I go to the pharmacy and give in my prescriptions, and I get the medicines."
"I see, signora. And are you exempt from paying the full price for this medicine?"
"Of course.
It's the least I can get for the taxes I've been paying all my life.
And why should the rich not get something for what they contribute to the health system? Brunetti asked himself. From beside him he heard a whispered,
Brava,
from Grifoni. He saw that her praise had captured the older woman's attention as well. She looked at Grifoni.
Mark my words, my dear. By the time you're my age, there will be nothing left. They'll have stolen it all, the swine.
Could you tell us the name of the medicine, Signora?
Brunetti interrupted, not wanting to open those particular floodgates.
Oh, don't ask me about things like that. They're what my doctor prescribes, and I take them.
Brunetti understood her reluctance to name her diseases, although their signs were evident in every tremor, twitch, and failure of memory.
I see, Signora. And the coupons?
Sometimes when I'm very busy or I have too many things on my mind, I forget to take my prescription with me.
She spoke as though her days were a succession of meetings and boardroom decisions, instead of time spent in this room, without books, without television, without company.
And then what happens, if I might ask?
Oh, Dottor Donato knows how important my medicines are for my health, but without the prescriptions he can't submit the forms to the health system.
Of course,
Grifoni muttered as if involuntarily.
So what does he do to help you, Signora? Brunetti inquired.
He asks me to pay for it, the full price, instead of the 2 euros I'm supposed to pay, and then he gives me a coupon.
She looked at them, and they smiled. Encouraged by their approval, she waved them closer to her with bent fingers and pointed to the door so that they would understand that Beata was not to hear this. Lowering her voice, she went on.
Dottor Donato told me that if we did it this way, he'd be able to add 20% to the value of the coupons.
Both of them smiled, and Grifoni could not resist exclaiming,
Oh, that's very kind of him, Signora.
As though to suggest the pharmacist should be given an award for exemplary citizenship.
He doesn't have to, I know, but he's a kind man,
Signora Gasparini said with a smile that showed the perfection of her teeth. She sat up, wiped away her smile, and said,
And it doesn't hurt anyone, does it? Not at all,
Grifoni assured her. They had obviously won her confidence because she continued.
Dottor Donato said it's an offer he makes only to faithful clients, people he can trust.
She stopped abruptly, as if she'd heard an echo of what she had just said.
He asked me not to talk about it, so please don't say anything.
She studied them closely, as though suddenly noticing them there, listening to her, and said,
I know I can rely on you. Of course you can, Signora,
Grifoni said, with just the right note of piety in her voice.
I understand him completely, Brunetti began, voice rich with admiration. And what with the cost of medicine today, 20% would...
He was cut off by Grifoni, who waved a hand in the direction of the Signora's face, as though she were a magician and Signora Gasparini the rabbit, saying,
And your complexion is certainly proof that a woman should buy only the best.
Signora Gasparini's face grew thoughtful when she heard that, and she started speaking again.
He's apologized to me more than once, that the regulations of the health system are so complicated that he really can't return the money to me without them finding out he gave me the drug without a prescription. If that happened, he told me they'd take his license away. He's been such a good friend to me that I can't risk that.
Grifoni and Brunetti nodded in agreement, which created a grotesque scene of three nodding heads in the same limited space. Using his most concerned voice, Brunetti asked,
Do you recall how many times this has happened over the years, that you've forgotten to bring your prescriptions with you?
Friendly and solicitous, he paid close attention to her face. He saw her eyes close slowly, and, when they opened again, seemed faintly out of focus, as though a different person had been called upon to play the next part of the scene.
"Over the years, it's been, oh," she said,
her surprise conspicuously audible.
"I don't really remember."
She looked from one to the other, as though the missing number might be written on their foreheads, and if only she looked hard enough, she'd find it. But apparently this was not to be. Ordinarily, Brunetti would have repeated the question, but it was evident that Signora Gasparini had decided not to remember. Consequently, he changed the topic and said with great earnestness,
"How lucky you are to find a pharmacist who cares enough about his clients to take that risk."
She smiled, hearing her sudden loss of memory dismissed by this man as both convincing and unimportant. Her confidence in them and their discretion restored, she leaned forward again and in a lowered voice said,
"That's exactly what Signora Lamont told me. She was at the counter ahead of me one day, and I couldn't help hearing their conversation. She'd forgotten her prescription, and Dottor Donato took out one of the coupons for her. When I saw her in Tonolo a few days ago—I go there for the mini beignets, especially the dark chocolate ones—and when I saw her, I told her that he'd done it for me, too."
She paused here, as one does in a long conversation, trying to remember if one has already said something. Perhaps assured by her memory that she had not, she continued,
"She told me she has two friends he also does it for."
She clasped her hands in front of her bosom in an old-fashioned gesture and said,
"He's so kind that he does it for us."
Seamlessly, as though one person's virtue led to another's, Brunetti said,
"He's lucky to be able to work so closely with Dottoressa Ruberti, who surely must be another extremely kind person."
He continued without pause, hoping to divert her from asking how he knew who her doctor was, and added,
"My mother-in-law's gone to her for years, and never ceases to sing her praises."
Grifoni put on a smile and nodded a few times at the truth of this. The old woman saw the smile, but had apparently forgotten the face on which it appeared.
"Yes, she is," Signora Gasparini concurred. "And she's brave, like Dottor Donato, ready to take chances to see that her patients are well taken care of." "Oh?"
Grifoni said with the enthusiastic curiosity of a younger person.
"What has she done for you, Signora?"
Signora Gasparini opened her mouth to answer, but paused, as if struck by sudden difficulty in recalling just what the doctor had done for her. Brunetti saw the same panic in her eyes that he had seen in his mother's, when, in the early stages, she had failed to remember something. So he asked,
"How long has she been your doctor, Signora?"
As if Grifoni had not asked the other question. Perhaps this was less complicated, for she said,
"For the last 10 years. My family doctor retired, and Dottoressa Ruberti took over the practice."
At the sight of these two young people, nodding encouragingly, she went on,
"She's Venetian. My father went to school with her grandfather."
She smiled, perhaps at having been able to remember this.
"We discovered this a few months after I started to go to her, and I suppose it was a sort of bond for us."
"Of course," Brunetti muttered. "That way you could be sure she'd take a personal interest in your health."
"Exactly," she said.
Then almost proudly she went on,
"I didn't go to her often at the beginning, you understand. Not like many of the old women around here. Not until about a year ago, when I had a few tests at the hospital and Dottoressa Ruberti prescribed me some medicine."
She stopped, and Brunetti wondered if she was willing herself to forget about her illness and to ignore the continual snap, snap, snap of her head. He certainly could not. She pulled her hands from the arms of her chair and interlocked her fingers, forcing her joined hands down on her lap.
"I went to my old pharmacist, the one I used to go to, and he told me that there was another medicine identical to the one Dottoressa Ruberti prescribed that was, what do you call it?"
She brought one hand to her forehead.
"What is it? Something with a G."
Brunetti saw her fear, the tightness of her mouth, and asked, "Do you mean generic, signora?"
"Yes, yes, that's it. Of course, I was just about to say it."
She smiled and made no attempt to hide her relief.
"I told him I had to speak to my doctor about this, and when I did, she told me that the medicines weren't the same. That the one she'd prescribed for me cost more because it had been proven to be better."
She closed her eyes in the frustration of age and powerlessness.
"It's what they do to us, try to save money in any way they can, no matter if it kills us."
Brunetti made a comforting noise but said nothing.
"I went back the next day and told the pharmacist I wouldn't take the generic,"
she began, evidently proud of having remembered the word.
"And when he refused to listen to me, I walked out. When I told Dottoressa Ruberti what had happened, she said she'd wanted to warn me about the pharmacist, but couldn't do that because of her professional ethics. She said she was glad I'd seen for myself, and she knew a pharmacist who would give me the right medicine."
"Thank God,"
Grifoni whispered.
"Yes, thank God indeed. They saved my life."
Instead of thankful, the old woman sounded anguished, as if the struggle had exhausted her and haunted her still.
"So that's how you came to be a client of Dr. Donato?"
Brunetti asked in childlike innocence, as though he were eager to hear the end of a fairy tale.
"Yes, it's the best thing that could have happened. To have a wonderful doctor and a pharmacist who have the same concern for the well-being of their patients."
Chapter 25. Outside, the day was drawing down, bringing with it a taste of the deeper chill that would soon be upon them. Grifoni turned up the collar of her coat and kept her arms across her chest while they walked towards Rialto. When they arrived at Rizzardini, Brunetti asked if she'd like something to drink, and she said she needed a coffee. Inside the tiny pasticceria, they both asked for a coffee, and she asked for a cannolo, saying,
"It's the only place here where I might be at home, at least for the pastries."
The pastry and the coffees came, and they moved to the end of the bar, close to the door. She took a sip and made a face.
"What's wrong?" Brunetti asked.
"I'm not in Naples, is what's wrong,"
she said seriously, but then remembered to smile to suggest she was only joking. She picked up the cylindrical pastry and took a bite. Crumbs rained down the front of her coat.
"It's not that the coffee's bad. It's more that people up here simply don't know what good coffee is, or don't know how to make it."
She pushed the cup farther away with a stiff finger and took another bite, then finished the cream-filled pastry and wiped her mouth with a paper napkin, the front of her coat, with her hand.
"The pastry's very good, though."
Brunetti finished his coffee, having thought it was fine and trying to remember the coffee he had drunk ages ago when he was stationed temporarily in Naples. He remembered the pasta and the fish, but not the coffee, save that it was half the size of the one he had just drunk, and two were enough to energize him for hours. The bar was warm, and they were alone at the counter.
"What do you think?"
"My best friend's grandmother suffered from Alzheimer's, and Signora Gasparini," she began, then corrected herself with a smile, "and my Aunt Matilda reminds me of her. Sometimes her memory works, other times it doesn't. When she lets down her guard, she's a feeble old woman who's showing signs of Parkinson's, losing her memory and trying to hide those facts for as long as she can.
She reached into the pocket of her coat and put a 5-euro note on the counter. The barman brought her change and took the cups and saucers away.
"And so?" Brunetti asked.
Grifoni didn't answer, but turned to the door and opened it. She walked out into the main calle, turned into the first on the left, and stopped, looking at the pastries in the window.
"Gasparini had the coupons. He got them from his aunt," she said, speaking slowly as she ordered things in her mind. "She knew the same was being done for other people, and she may have told her nephew that as well. Perhaps he confronted Donato and told him he knew what he was doing, or threatened to come to us."
She paused but did not look at him.
"Why would Gasparini bother to tell him?" Brunetti asked. "Why not simply do it? Come to us with the coupons and whatever information his aunt had given him. About Signora Lamon, for example."
Grifoni put her hands into the pockets of her jacket and rolled up and down on the balls of her feet. Brunetti could all but hear the gears in her mind shifting higher, then back again to a low, steady beat, then up again to high. When she still failed to answer, Brunetti said,
"You're right that he might have known about the others. It took less than a half an hour for your aunt to tell us about them."
Grifoni said only, "Signora Lamon."
"Why would Donato limit himself to medicines for Parkinson's and Alzheimer's?" Brunetti asked.
He thought for a while and continued.
"The ones for psychological problems are expensive, especially when they're first put on the market."
He thought, but did not say, that the people who were prescribed this kind of drug were also the people most likely to forget to take their prescriptions with them to the pharmacy, and the least likely to pay close attention to the price of their medicines, or how or what they paid for them. People trusted their pharmacists as much as they did their doctors, he knew, perhaps even more, and trusted them with their secrets.
Donato would know if the families were rich, or whether someone in the family would become suspicious at the disappearance of 100 euros every once in a while, he said.
Grifoni took her eyes from the pastries and turned to look at him.
A pharmacist would probably be able to judge how serious their disease had become from reading the prescription. He could probably estimate how forgetful they were likely to be, especially people with the beginnings of Alzheimer's.
Brunetti nodded, asking himself how many of the coupons would be forgotten about or lost by the people who paid for them. If, months later, they found a few stuffed in a drawer, how many of them would remember what they were?
"It could be a gold mine, couldn't it?"
Grifoni said.
"But what about the other people working there?" he asked.
In response to her glance, he said,
"I don't know if they'd all suggest a client pay the full price in return for a coupon."
He drew to a sudden halt.
"Are we agreed that they'd all have to be complicit in what's going on?"
"They'd have to know," Grifoni said. "I don't know if that's complicity."
"What else would it be?"
Brunetti asked in a voice he intentionally kept calm.
"Avoiding trouble? Keeping your job? Minding your own business?"
She paused to see that he'd heard and understood her, and then said,
"Remember the Bible, Guido."
"What?"
he asked, unable to disguise his astonishment.
"You? Saying that?"
She smiled at the intensity of his response. She patted his arm and said,
"Don't worry, Guido. I'm talking only about the 7 fat years and the 7 lean years. We had lots of fat years, now the lean years have begun. So people, even pharmacists, are far less brave than they were in the past, far less able to risk losing their jobs."
"Able or willing?" Brunetti asked with northern vigor.
"Willing,"
conceded Grifoni, the Neapolitan.
"They take an oath. Like doctors," Brunetti insisted.
Certainly,
she said amiably.
But I'm not sure that means much anymore. Not to most people. They want to survive. Keep their heads down and survive, so that's what they do.
Keep their heads down? He asked.
Yes.
Brunetti didn't like knowing that she was right. He looked at his watch and saw that it was after 6. Idiotic to go back to work when he was so close to home.
You going to get a boat? He asked Grifoni.
Yes, but I'm not going back to the Questura. If Lieutenant Scarpa asks me where I was, I'll say I was following a suspect all the way down to San Pietro in Castello.
He laughed at the idea of anyone who is not a Venetian trying to do that, and they turned back towards Rialto, Brunetti having decided to accompany her to San Silvestro.
Last weekend, she began, I went over to Angelo Raffaele and spent 2 hours walking around.
Were you lost? Brunetti asked.
I don't know. I wasn't going anywhere or looking for anything. I simply walked around in circles. Well, rectangular circles, until I began to recognize shops I'd passed or restaurants that were on corners where I'd turned before. I always turned at the bottom of the second bridge I came to.
And? He asked.
I think I have a vague sense of where things are.
It's not easy.
I know, I know. You have to have been born here.
It helps, Brunetti said,
just as they turned into the calle that led to the Embarcadero. He looked at his watch.
There's a boat going towards the Lido in 2 minutes.
She turned and stared at him.
Do you have them programmed into your memory?
This is my stop, so I know the times.
Ah.
She pulled her wallet from her bag and extracted her IMOB. Brunetti heard the motor of the approaching boat. After a few seconds, so did she.
And tomorrow?
She asked.
What do we do?
I'll think about it, Brunetti answered,
and turned back toward the underpass. After dinner, Brunetti went into Paola's study and extended himself on her sofa, hands clasped behind his head. He had left the door ajar, allowing light to come into the room from the hallway. Outside it was dark. Dimness was the proper setting. He stared at the ceiling and thought about his own pharmacy in Campo San Bortolo, just to the statue's left. He went there because, well, because he had always gone there. He closed his eyes and imagined walking in, going up to the counter with a prescription. From the front room of the apartment he heard voices, Chiara and Raffi. One of them laughed. It was such a normal sound that Brunetti barely noticed it. Of course, no one paid any attention to what a pharmacist did. He took your prescription, brought you the medicine, and told you what to pay. Had his pharmacist told Brunetti that a medicine cost 22 euros instead of 2, he would not have questioned the price. If the pharmacist told a person taking medicine against mental confusion, but who had forgotten to bring the necessary prescription, that the only way they could have their medicine was to pay full price for it and receive, as a guarantee of future repayment, a coupon for the pharmacy, who would question him? If the client refused, then the pharmacist had only to apologize for having suggested an alternative procedure in hopes of saving his client another trip to the pharmacy, and tell them they simply had to return with the prescription to have the medicine they needed at the usual price, and never try it with that client again. Would someone actually do this? Risk his profession for so little? He remembered a well-known and very successful lawyer who had been caught last year shoplifting 3 ties from Hermes. Vice Questora Patta had put a lockdown on that one. No charges had been brought, nor had information been slipped to Il Gazzettino, which would certainly have smacked its lips over the story. Brunetti had understood Patta's decision. A moment's folly should not incinerate a career and a reputation. 20 years ago he knew his response would have been different, more punitive, more fierce.
"How Italian you're becoming," he said out loud.
"That's a good thing. I'd hate to think I'd married an Australian and never noticed,"
Paola said, pushing the door open with her foot. She carried a tray with 2 cups of coffee, 2 small glasses, and a tall, thin bottle that looked as if it might contain grappa. Chapter 26 Brunetti was awakened from deep sleep at about 4 by the sound of rushing wind. He sat up, alarmed at the noise and uncertain for a moment where he was. He extended his right hand and found Paola's shoulder, searched for and saw the familiar pattern thrown on the far wall by the light that managed to filter in from the streetlights 5 floors below. He waited for the noise to come again. It did not. He lay back on his pillow, but the sound did not return. The night lay silent on his ears. Had he been dreaming of something? Where had the wind come from? Where had his sleeping self been? He had nothing more than a vague memory of having been in a dimly lit room. He studied the light, uncertain whether he would be able to return to sleep. He thought of Dr. Donato and the many things they did not know about him: family, habits, friends, business history. From nowhere came the realization that he had the same absence of information about Gasparini. He was a man with a problematic son and was now a figure attached to machines and lying inert in a hospital bed. Like Donato, he surely must have a past that might help explain his present. The same could easily be said of Dottoressa Ruberti. He started to make a list of what he would ask Signorina Elettra to examine, but soon gave up at the awareness that she had become so adept at the hunt that she was now the person who best knew what to look for and where. He began, nevertheless, to list the things he wanted to know: family, possible previous contact with the police, financial status, other... Ideas loosened in his mind, and Brunetti soon drifted off, carried on far more gentle winds than those imagined ones that had torn him from sleep. He went directly to Signorina Elettra's office when he arrived at the Questura, not at all sure what the mood would be after their last awkward meeting. That was left unsettled because she was on the phone when he entered. The first thing he noted was a vase of flowers on her desk. He had no idea what they were. Surely not tulips or roses. Dark, almost purple. He could not remember seeing flowers so somber, as if they believed that brightening a room was not part of their mission. She sat behind them, partially obscured. Seeing him, she raised a hand in greeting, then used it to point repeatedly to the door to Patta's office, and said into the receiver,
"He's just come in, dottore. Do you have time to see him now?"
During the brief pause while she waited for Vice Questore Patta's answer, she raised one hand and gave a shrug, to suggest she had no idea what her superior wanted from Brunetti.
"Good. I'll ask him to go in."
She replaced the receiver and pointed to the door. He took 2 steps, paused, and turned back to her.
"I know you've already had a look at Dottor Donato, but could you take another look at his private life? Same with Gasparini and Dottoressa Ruberti."
Before she could answer, Brunetti went to the door and entered without knocking. The Vice Questore was bent over his desk. Visible only were his shoulders and part of his back. As Brunetti watched, his head moved up and down, each time just a few centimeters.
"Is something wrong, Vice Questore?" Brunetti asked, moving quickly towards his superior's desk.
Suddenly, like a marionette popping from a box, the rest of Patta appeared, facing Brunetti, who had stopped just short of his desk.
"Just tying my shoe," Patta explained.
his face flushed by having risen up so quickly. When Brunetti failed to answer, Patta said, "Have a seat, Commissario. There's something I'd like to inform you about." Brunetti did as he was told, crossed his legs, and placed his hands